It's Thursday, January 23rd, 2014. I'm Albert Mohler, and this is The Briefing, a daily analysis of news and events from a Christian worldview. There is a great deal of discussion in America about income inequality and the vexing problem of poverty. A lot of the conversation is nonsense, and a lot of it reveals a worldview confusion that's both toxic and unnerving. On the other hand, from the Christian worldview perspective, there are few issues more worthy of our consideration than a just arrangement of an economy and a just arrangement of a society that will reward the things that the Scripture makes very clear are the things that lead to human flourishing. The opportunities for work, a reward between work and income, the opportunity to save and to invest, to exercise thrift and good judgment. There are good things to be discussed here, and these get to some of the most basic issues that Christians have struggled with for centuries. But when you think about the problem of income inequality, particularly in America, there is one undeniable and inescapable correlation, and that is the correlation between income inequality and family structure. And yet, that's the one thing that most people in Washington don't want to discuss. An article that recently appeared in the Wall Street Journal makes the point emphatically. It's written by Ari Fleischer, former press secretary for President George W. Bush. The title of his article says, How to Fight Income Inequality, Get Married. And by the way, those two words need to be followed by stay married, and then by the words have your children only within the context of marriage. Fleischer writes, if President Obama wants to reduce income inequality, he should focus less on redistributing income and more on fighting a major cause of modern poverty, the breakdown of the family. Now, I will interject there the fact that the data demonstrate that it's not just a major factor in poverty, it is the leading factor in poverty. It doesn't explain all poverty, certainly doesn't explain all income inequality, but it does explain the major causation. A man mostly raised by single mother and his grandparents who defied the odds to become president of the United States, Fleischer says, is just the person to take up the cause. And in that, he is certainly right. Marriage inequality should be at the center of any discussion of why some Americans prosper and others don't, he says. According to the Census Bureau, families headed by two married parents in 2012, that meant that just 7.5% of them lived in poverty. By contrast, when families are headed by a single mother, the poverty level jumps to 33.9%. Remember now that those figures come directly from the United States Census Bureau. Again, among those who are raised in a two-parent, married-parent home, only 7.5% are listed in poverty. That skyrockets to 33.9% if the household is headed by a single mom. To make the moral point emphatically clear, Fleischer writes, attitudes towards marriage and having children have changed in America over the past 50 years, and low-income children and their mothers are the ones who are paying the price. A study recently released by the Heritage Foundation found that 28.6% of children born to a white mother are born out of wedlock. That's a figure that has never even been approached before. For Hispanics, the figure is 52.5%. For African Americans, 72.3%. He then makes this statement. In 1964, when Lyndon Baines Johnson declared the war on poverty, almost everyone was born into a family with two married parents. Only 7% were not. That is, nationwide, 93% of all children in 1964, when President Johnson declared the war on poverty, were born to two married parents. Now, that figure has skyrocketed to unprecedented double digits, with over 30% of American children of all races and ethnicities now born outside of wedlock. The Heritage Foundation report gets right to the heart of the issue. Quote, the U.S. is steadily separating into a two-caste system, with marriage and education as the dividing line. In the high-income third of the population, children are raised by married parents with a college education. In the bottom-income third, children are raised by single parents with a high school diploma or less. Fleischer then comments, one of the differences between the haves and the have-nots is that the haves tend to marry and give birth in that order. The have-nots tend to have babies and remain unmarried. Marriage makes a difference, he says. The reports and data indicate that among white married couples, the poverty rate in 2009 was just 3.2%, but for white non-married families, the rate was 22%. Among black married couples, the poverty rate was 7%, but the rate for non-married black families was 35.6%. Now, what does this tell us? It tells us that the social science research underlines the fact that marriage is truly important. But as Christians, we didn't need social science to tell us this. The Bible tells us this. Our Creator tells us this. Marriage is one of the great gifts of the Creator in the act of creation, and marriage is given to all peoples everywhere. It is one of those acts by His grace, the grace that is demonstrated in the creation not only of the cosmos and of human beings, but of those most basic institutions that lead to human happiness and human flourishing. And as Christians well understand, within the context of Christian marriage, marriage is actually an instrument of our holiness as well. On the same issue, a recent article appeared in the Palm Beach Post from Florida, written by Randy Schultz. He talks about the very same kind of information. As he writes, the Census Bureau reported just this past May that more than 6 of 10 American women in their early 20s are unmarried when they have their first child. Single motherhood has been rising over the past 20 years. In 2011, 36% of births in the United States were to unwed mothers. Put a different way, 36% of births were to unwed fathers. That's a very interesting twist in the tale. And what Randy Schultz here has done in the Palm Beach Post is shift the issue from talking just about unwed mothers to the unwed fathers, who actually are, of course, the genetic fathers of these children. In other words, the problem of having children born to unwed mothers is not only a problem of unwed mothers. By definition, it's a problem of unwed people who are having these children. Only as it happens, it is the mother who has the child. It's the mother who is left with the child in so many cases. It's the father who abandons both the mother and the child, leading to this incredible pattern of widespread, pervasive, uncorrectable poverty. Because as the data make clear, there is no way to correct the full brokenness of what happens when the family unit is marginalized and when marriage is subverted. There's another interesting data point that appears in the Palm Beach Post article, and it's one I haven't seen before. It comes down to this. In 1970, there were 203 million Americans and 2.4 million marriages in just that one year, that is, weddings. In 2011, there were 2.1 million marriages, that is, weddings, but that's against a population of 314 million today. In other words, if people were now in the United States marrying at the same rate in the population they did just in 1970, there would be 600,000 more weddings last year. Or there would have been, but there weren't. As I said, I haven't seen that statistic before, but it's very telling. Indeed, it's immediately illuminating. It tells us that there were 600,000 fewer weddings last year than there should have been in terms of the size of the population. A recent report from the Census Bureau, it's the same basic report from which these articles are drawing this data. What we're looking at in that Census Bureau report was the fact that cohabitation, unmarried cohabitation, is now the customary first romantic living arrangement for couples in the United States. And that tells us a great deal about the problem of poverty. It tells us a great deal about the background in terms of the secularization of the culture. People are clearly not feeling even any guilt, even any residual guilt from a Christian memory of living together without marriage. But again, I want to go back to this article by Randy Schultz and say he has offered us two very important insights. The first was this whole idea of missing marriages. Those missing weddings really do make a huge difference. But the other issue is how he uses the phrase unwed fathers. We need to bring the father back into the equation. From a Christian worldview perspective, we understand there's no way we can actually talk about unwed mothers without at the same time talking about the unwed fathers. Shifting to another issue of great concern to Christians, The Guardian, a left-wing paper in Great Britain, is giving front-page attention to a story that originates in Seattle, Washington, in a Catholic school, where the CEO of the Catholic school fired a very popular assistant principal as a man for getting married to another man. In other words, for publicly flaunting the teaching of the church, defying the teaching of the Catholic Church, and marrying another man. As you may remember from this having been mentioned in the briefing before, the controversy in Seattle gets really messy. It gets messy because, as it turned out, Sister Mary Tracy, the CEO of the school, was found to have told this assistant principal that he could keep his job if he just got unmarried from the man with whom he was involved in a homosexual relationship. In other words, the president of the school seems to be equally confused with the assistant principal she eventually fired. But then the story grows even more difficult and complex earlier this week, when Sister Mary Tracy, the president of this Catholic school in Seattle, resigned, and the story of her resignation makes the story even more confounding. The bottom line from my consideration is this. As The Guardian reports, quote, in an email calling for broader community support of the fired assistant principal and the students, Michael Booney, who organizes the LGBTQ community of the Seattle-based St. Joseph Parish, wrote that Eastside Catholic, that's the school, was inconsistent with, quote, a policy that is selectively enforced against gay faculty, but not against straight employees who are divorced or living together out of wedlock, end quote. Now, why is that important to us? Well, it's important to us all because it points to the absolute necessity, not only legally, but far more importantly, morally and theologically, of a moral consistency. As Christians are thinking through so many of these issues and seeking to remain faithful to Scripture, we have to remind ourselves we have to remain faithful to the entire scriptural teaching on human sexuality. We can't all of a sudden come up with a problem with homosexuality if we don't have a moral problem with cohabitation, premarital sex, adultery, divorce, and any number of other issues. In other words, this Catholic school in Seattle serves as a parable for us, of the parable of all of a sudden deciding that one issue, very clearly addressed in Scripture, is of grave moral significance, while not considering other issues, even more pervasively taught in Scripture, as being of consequence. This kind of moral hypocrisy is costing this school. It's making headlines all the way across the Atlantic Ocean in Great Britain. And well, it should. And it should warn us all that if we do not seek to be faithful to all that the Scripture requires of us on the issue of sexual morality, we will be rightly accused of simply being arbitrary and unjust, intolerant and homophobic, if all of a sudden we come up with the issue only when it comes to homosexuality. Well, here's a story you might not have thought about. USA Today yesterday reports that U.S. Ambassador Caroline Kennedy, our ambassador to Japan, has created a controversy in Japan by sending out a tweet, that is a message on Twitter, suggesting that the United States government is opposed to a dolphin hunt recently held there. As Kirk Spitzer of USA Today reports, Japan accused critics of its annual dolphin hunt, including U.S. Ambassador Caroline Kennedy, of being hypocrites for not lamenting the killing of cattle and chickens in their countries for food. As USA Today reports, Japanese fishermen on Tuesday of this week trapped 250 dolphins in a cove. They used nets for that. They killed about 40 of them for food, and then they took about 50 of them for sale to aquariums. They took those live. The rest were set free. That according to a group known as Sea Shepherd, an environmental group known for its anti-whaling activities. Japanese officials were complaining about the message that was sent by Ambassador Kennedy. She tweeted, quote, deeply concerned by inhumaneness of drive hunt dolphin killing. USG, that means U.S. government, opposes drive hunt fisheries. Masahiro Sato, a Japanese lawmaker, suggested that the ambassador was acting inappropriately in her role as an ambassador, as a diplomat from the United States to Japan. One official Japanese response reads, quote, the drive hunt is a traditional fishery that was established long before the foundation of the United States of America. Another said, quote, isn't it inhumane to kill millions of cows and sheep for consumption? Japanese Chief Cabinet Secretary Yoshihide Suga said, quote, dolphin fishing is one of the traditional fishing forms of our country and is carried out appropriately in accordance with law. Dolphins are not covered by the International Whaling Commission control, and it's controlled under the responsibility of each country, end quote. So what do we do with that? Well, from a Christian perspective, perhaps we ought to think really carefully about the accusation made by the Japanese against us. In other words, why do we eat certain animals and not other animals? Is there a deep moral or worldview consideration, or is it a matter of taste and national custom? When it comes to dolphins, I don't think Americans ever think of eating dolphins, not porpoises in this case. The dolphin that served in American seafood restaurants is not the porpoise, but rather a different fish, not a mammal. But in Japan, they eat porpoises, even though they call them dolphins. And that's the controversy here. Of course, in the background to this is the animal rights movement, which certainly at its secular extreme is trying to argue that there's no distinction at all between the human creature and the other animals. And yet we understand that it is the human creature who alone is made in the image of God. And the Bible steadfastly, consistently makes a very clear and emphatic point that human beings are completely separate from the rest of creation in the sense that we are the only creature made in God's image, the only creature able consciously to worship and to know the Creator. And, of course, what we're looking at here is a rebellion against that very order in creation by those who are trying to erase the distinction. But when it comes to treatment of animals, even amongst those who eat animals and who understand that animals are given to us as they were in Genesis for our food and enjoyment, the reality is that every culture and every society privileges certain animals over others. In certain societies, they eat animals we have as pets in our homes. They would find it insane that we're actually coddling and keeping these pets and feeding them rather than feeding of them. On the other hand, just about every American is likely to look at this dolphin hunt in Japan and say, why would you eat a porpoise? But if hungry enough, it's likely that they would eat a porpoise too. There's an entire area of current ethical philosophy dealing with the ethics of meat, the ethics of eating, the ethics of farming, and what it means to make these choices. But Americans looking at a story like this are likely not to think in worldview terms, but rather just in terms of immediate sentiment. Our moral sentiment leads us not to want to eat things we consider as friends, fellow beings. That's why most Americans eat meat without thinking about it, because they've had no knowledge of the animal from which the flesh actually comes. There's a tremendous disconnect for most Americans in terms of how that steak that appears in the butcher shop, the grocery store, or for that matter, in the restaurant menu actually comes to us. But every single animal at some point had a personality and has some level of consciousness. Should we then decide that we don't eat porpoises because they have a great deal of intelligence as measured with other animals? Are we saying that we choose the ethics of eating by choosing to eat the animals that have the least amount of consciousness? Well, Americans, if that's the case, we're not actually doing that either. So what in the world do we make of this controversy between Japan and the United States? Well, at the very least, there should be the honest acknowledgement on the part of some Americans that the reason we do not eat some animals is sentiment. The reason why other peoples eat those animals is both sentiment and moral or national custom. The fact that we eat certain animals in certain ways means that we eat them that way because it makes sense within our culture. A very different animal might make a very different sense within a different culture, as this story makes very clear. The most important point, however, is to make the point that the great distinction is not among the animals, but the distinction between the animal kingdom and human creatures. The human being is categorically different. Categorically different not just because human beings have a larger brain and more consciousness. If we get into that scale, we're going to find ourselves right with Peter Singer, the bioethicist who infamously now teaches on the campus of Princeton University, who argues that there are pigs and cows who have more of a right to life than some children or some human beings who lack a certain amount of consciousness. If the scale of consciousness is the scale of the sanctity of human life, then anyone who has a risk to that consciousness is at grave risk. No, the issue is categorical, and the reality is the imago Dei, the image of God. If we lose that, even for a second, then everything and every human being is at risk. Before I close, I want to invite you to join me, along with nationally syndicated radio host Dennis Prager and New York Times columnist Ross Douthat, for a conversation about faith and freedom in the public square. Our goal is to have an open and honest dialogue about the challenges we face as a nation, as a culture, and as a civilization. Join us this coming Tuesday, January the 28th at 7 o'clock p.m. on the campus of the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary. Thanks for listening to The Briefing. For more information, go to my website at albertmoeller.com. You can follow me on Twitter by going to twitter.com/Albert Moeller. For information on the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary, go to sbts.edu. For information on Boyce College, just go to boycecollege.com. I'll meet you again tomorrow for The Briefing.